We're happy to have with us Neil Kinsey to talk about. He's known about managing fertilizers and soil fertility using the Albrecht system of cation balance and the both achieving the required levels of different minerals as well as the balance. He's going to talk to us today about the structure, building the foundation for life in the soil, that these fertility elements and the balance and the structure of the soil greatly determines the life in the soil. It's not just about inoculating the soil with life. It's having the foundation for them to for those life forms to prosper there. Neil Kinsey consults around the world and has done more to spread the wisdom of William Albrecht and that system of agronomy than anyone alive. We're happy to have with us Neil Kinsey.
Well, I seldom disagree with Fred. I'm supposed to use this one. I seldom disagree with Fred, but I have to say, I think his dad did more to spread about Albrecht than I. And I'm pleased to have had a part in it, whatever part that might be. Today, for most of you, if you've been to our meeting before, you're not going to hear anything new. You're just going to hear a repeat. But of all the things that we talk about, the real goal of the Albrecht system was building the life in the soil. Dr. Albrecht was in the soils department at University of Missouri, but he was originally hired as a soil microbiologist. His job when he first came there in 1918, 1919, 1920, was to teach farmers how to use inoculants on legumes. And actually, they thought that was the real big problem, and he said, when we taught them to use inoculants, because so many people didn't understand that you had specific inoculants for clovers or alfalfa or soybeans or peas or whatever, and they started them using inoculants, and some of the farmers got much better results, and other farmers didn't get that much better results. It wasn't just the inoculant. And what he learned was, it's the environment for the microbes in that soil that helps them do what they have to do. Now, that environment just happens to be what we're going to cover today, and that is you don't get the right environment without the right minerals, without the right nutrients in that soil. So that's what we're going to take a look at, building life in the soil. And this isn't any fast-track thing or anything else. This is actually just using the old science, chemistry, physics, and biology, and taking a look at how it works to build the life in the soil. Do you know the condition of your livestock? If you're a beef operator or have sheep or cattle or whatever, you'd say, yes, I think I have to be concerned about the condition of my livestock. This man growing corn, this is in Wyoming, but he'd say, yes, I'm concerned about my livestock. But this man grows corn in southeast Missouri, and he doesn't even have a fence on the place. And yet, he needs to be concerned about his livestock. He'd say, what livestock? The soil is alive. Feed the soil to help the soil feed the crops that you want to grow there. This is the philosophy that Dr. Albrecht always said. Why do you feed the soil? Not just because the plant needs something, but because the soil is the plant's stomach. And all those organisms that are there in that soil are there to prepare the nutrients so that the plants can use them properly. If you try to go around them, you try to take a shortcut, most of the time you're going to create problems instead of solving them. I'm not going to say you can't do it. People do it all the time. But do you get the best results? When we start looking at soils, we need to understand that even though you may not have a cow standing on top, for every acre of land that you farm or grow anything on, you're feeding the equivalent of one cow per acre before you ever feed the crop that you're growing. And the reason being, everything in that soil, the microbes, the biology in that soil, eats first. And then the plants get what's left over. So the plants eat at the second table. So when you're out there growing, if you don't happen to have any livestock, yes, you still do. On the average, microbiologists or those that study the soil will tell you in an acre of soil, there's enough live organisms that if you weighed them out, it would weigh about the same as an average-sized cow. So every one of you are feeding livestock if you're growing something, whether it's on your lawn, whether it's in your garden, whether it's tree crops, whether it's vegetables or fruits or grain crops. If you don't have any other livestock, there's the place they live. And basically, that's the real place they live, because most of the humus-forming organisms in the soil are in the top 2 inches. The life of that soil is the real life of that soil is the top 2 inches, because that's where the chief amount of decomposition builds. What are we talking about? Now, I'm no microbiologist, but just in terms of, most people think, well, earthworms and microbes, that's what's in the soil. Well, let's not forget the plant root as well. But in terms of microbial life in the soil, this was taken from a presentation by the Phosphate Potash Institute in the 1950s. Where they discussed just a little bit about the animal life in the soil. Protozoa, the smallest forms of animal life, and some people probably even disagree with that by now, but just the same, there's one form of life in the soil is the protozoa. Probably the more famous animal life in the soil is nematodes, which are in some places called eelworms or eel-like animals that can be serious parasites, but most of them aren't. Most of the nematodes in the soil are actually beneficial nematodes. And as a matter of fact, if you talk to people that study it, they'll tell you generally 95% of the nematodes are beneficial, not harmful. It's just that, like diseases in us or whatever, sometimes things get out of balance and then nematodes come in because the conditions in the soil get out of whack, and it gives them an unfair advantage. And then we get those parasitic-type nematodes. Years ago, when I first started working with the soils in southeast Missouri, had one farmer that balanced out his soils, and while he was doing it, one of the landowners had a pasture that kept cattle in all the time. Otherwise, he didn't have any cattle. He had all row crops. But every time he had me do the soils, he'd also have me do the pastures. A lot of people don't do that. You'll talk to a lot of people, and they'll do soil tests on everything else but the pasture. Well, why do that? We got the cows, we got the manure. You don't need to do anything. Yes, you do. Most pastures that we check are severely deficient in nutrients. But he had us check, and he would add the nutrients to that pasture every time. Well, then finally, the decision was made by the owner, we don't want to keep the cattle anymore. Just go ahead and farm that like the rest of the land. And he wanted to put soybeans there. So he said, I'd like you to do not just a soil test, but I'd like you to do another test so that we can examine it for nematode and see if we need to plant race-resistant soybean seed. Well, we sent the sample in for nematode sample, and the lab rang back and said, where did you get this soil sample? I said, well, it came off Barney's farm. We've been sending them in for years. Why? They said, well, you asked to have this nematode analysis done. And they said, it is the highest amount of beneficial nematodes we've ever seen in a soil. Now, they went in there and balanced it out. And, yes, there were some race 4 soybean cyst nematode there, so he still had to plant a special soybean, because light sandy soils in that area generally have cyst nematode. But the comment was not about the cyst nematode. The comment was about such high populations of beneficial nematodes. You build the environment in the soil, and the life of that soil is going to show differently. I'll just add this here. I had a client that started with us in 1978, and about 2005, I was talking to him on the phone, and he said, Neil, we tried a new biological inoculant this year. And he tried a number of different things. And he said, I wanted to tell you that my farm, because of the company, it was a new company he had tried, and he said, they've chosen me as one of 12 farms to send in samples from to have them analyzed by microbial analysis by Dr. Elaine Ingham. And he said, that was already done, and I got the results back. And he said, out of the 12 farmers, guess where my farm rated? This guy had worked on his nutrient balance since 78 and had done all types of things, including he was a conventional farmer, but he said, I don't have to use herbicides on my corn because I don't have enough weeds to do it. He said, I can actually grow corn without putting herbicides on. He was a Pioneer seed corn dealer. They wouldn't even put that in their literature. They wouldn't put in their literature what he did. They wouldn't even put the amount of nitrogen that he used, because they said, you can't grow corn. You can't grow that much corn with that much nitrogen. You're not telling us the truth. Well, at any rate, he said, guess where I rated? And I said, Bill, I don't really know who all else was in the contest, but I know one thing. You've been on the program since 1978. If you weren't at the top, I think you'd be right there. And I wasn't just saying that. I really believed it. And he said, of all the farms, I was number one. He said, it came back, and everything was rated that it was where it was supposed to be. He had never added a microbe to that farm. He had never bought a microbial. He had purchased biological stimulants over the years from different companies, but he had never added a microbe. What he had done was supply the nutrient elements that would keep that soil in the proper, to have the proper nutrients, and also, if you keep the proper nutrients in the soil, you'll also affect the physical structure of that soil. And that's what he did. He kept the right amount of air and water in there, because of the chemistry of the soil determines the physical structure, which builds the house for the biology. He built the house for the biology, and like that old movie said, you build it and they'll come. Well, you build it and the biology will start building. Now, I'm not going to say that you've got the ideal biology in 1 or 2 or 3 years. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you, I don't think we still have the ideal biology in 30 years. Because some of the fellows will tell you that as time goes on, they're using the same rates of fertilizer, but their yields are going up. Now, if that's happening, how can you justify or say, well, I'm not using so much fertilizer, I'm not using twice the fertilizer, but I got twice the yields? The biological aspects are what has to be doing it, because it's not because you're forcing the land with more fertilizer. I'm not saying fertilizer forces the land, but I'm saying if you use too much, you're forcing. Microbial plants in the soil. Bacteria. Now, I don't know what happens, but this always shows up on my computer just right, and you can read everything. And every time we put it up here, that one on bacteria gets up there and you can't even read it. But anyway, bacteria actually thrive in high pH soils or single-cell microbes. The fungi tolerate more acid soils. But Dr. Sylvan Whitmer, in his work with microbes, and he has a book called The Soil Microbe. He and another person published it together. But in that book, he makes the statement, if you have a soil that has a pH between 6 and 6.5, the fungi can thrive and the bacteria can thrive. Dr. Albrecht used to always say the ideal soil has a pH of 6, no higher than a pH of 6.5. Well, when we get the pH right, the fungi can work fine and so can the bacteria. But if we're growing a legume and you don't know where you ought to be, well, what do? You put it up on the high side. But the best alfalfa doesn't grow in a high pH soil. The best alfalfa grows in the same soil that the best corn grows in, that the best watermelon grows in, that the best blueberry grows in, and they're all the same soil. When you get all the nutrients in the soil and let the soil feed the plant, whatever plant you want to grow there will do its best. And we have blueberry growers that will tell you, we grow the best crops we've ever grown, and their pH is not in the fives, their pH is about between 6.3 and 6.5. They'll tell you it's the biggest blueberries we have ever grown, it's the sweetest blueberries we've ever grown, and it's the highest tonnage we've ever grown. And it isn't a matter that they've done it for a year or two. We've got clients that have done this for years. A blueberry will stand a low pH soil, because at a low pH, at least the iron and manganese is most available. If you come in there and put lime on that soil, raise the pH, a certain amount of iron and manganese are going to be tied up by that, and if you tie up too much, the blueberries aren't going to do well. And in so many of the really light soils where blueberries are planted, the iron and manganese is just at critical levels already. You put something on there, and it's going to make it look like, well, calcium is tearing this up. But really what happens is you're not feeding them with the iron and the manganese they need. As long as you correct that soil and keep the iron and manganese where it needs to be, those blueberries will do the best they can do. Dr. L.E. McComber came to the first course that I ever put on, and that was at an Acres conference in Kansas City in 1994. And when he walked through the door, he handed me a picture. Dr. McComber was a blueberry grower from Michigan. I don't know how many of you might have known him, but he used to attend Acres conferences. And I can't remember, but in 94, I think he told me he was 82. But anyway, he walked in and handed me a picture, and he said, "Neil, I just wanted to tell you I read your book, and you said the best blueberries grow where the best sweet corn and the best tomatoes grow." And he said, "I've been growing blueberries for 40 years. Here's a picture of my best blueberries. They're right there in the garden, and here's the tomatoes on this side, and here's the corn on this side, and you're right. It's the best blueberries I grow." You've got to have all the nutrients there, though. Otherwise, it's better to have that low pH soil, because the fungi will actually help those blueberries more than the bacteria will. Actinomycetes are immediate between bacteria and fungi, and if you ever go out and work the soil and have that real fresh plowed or fresh worked odor, that's the actinomycetes you're smelling. And then finally, the algae in the soil, some fix nitrogen, some carry on photosynthesis. But in terms of that algae, if you can stimulate the right, you can actually measure an increase in nitrogen building in your soil. It's just that most of the time, we're not working to do that. Important aspects of soil organisms. They decompose organic residues with release of nutrient element constituents. In other words, as they break down your stalks, they're going to release nutrients. And the two chief nutrients they release is potassium and phosphorus from whatever's in your crop. But that's the ones you'll generally see build up the fastest because of the activities of microorganisms. That's why if you use moderate amounts of compost or moderate amounts of manure, then the life in that soil will give you a moderation level of phosphorus and potassium. But if you use excessive amounts, those microbes will then break down and begin to build phosphate and or potash to excess. And as the excess goes up, then you start tying up other nutrients. And it's because the microbes in that soil, first of all, decompose what's in the residues. We need microbes to form soil humus, and yes, that's true, but we need the right amount of calcium and the right amount of carbon in order to do that. And many people believe they're building humus when really they're having trouble just staying where they are simply because we're not really feeding the proper amount of carbon and nitrogen for those microbes to do their job. It takes roughly, well, if you look at we get compost and manures to analyze, and we'll sometimes receive a quote compost from someone that's an organic grower, and they'll say, "Well, we'd like you to analyze this compost we're going to buy so we can put it on our crops." If the carbon to nitrogen ratio is less than 10 to 1, that's not compost, that's manure. And a tremendous amount of what's called compost is not compost, it's manure. Now, if that makes any difference to you, in other words, as far as that, you can use manures, but certified organic is supposed to use compost. Well, sometimes we have to send back and say, "This is not really a compost, this is a manure." If your carbon to nitrogen is between 10 and 20 parts carbon for every one part nitrogen, that's where your levels have to be to build compost or to build the humus in the soil, to build the humus side. In other words, your compost has to have that level to build the humus. So formation of humus is in that category. Now, if you get up on the high side and it's higher than 20 to 1, now all of a sudden the microbes start tying up all the nitrogen and you rob your crop of the nitrogen it needs to be able to grow until you come back and supply it from some other source. So if you get too little, the nitrogen fuels the microbes and they turn around and consume all the organic matter and then they look for another food source and the only one that's left is humus, and they actually will turn around and use that. The nitrogen gives them the energy and they'll actually use that humus for a food source. That's where the term burning out humus comes from. Too much nitrogen in relation to carbon. And then when it comes to the other side, too much carbon in relation to nitrogen robs the crop you're trying to grow of the nitrogen it needs in order to do its best. Microbes are organisms. Soil organisms also improve physical structure or physical properties of the soil. If you don't believe it, take a soil as hard as you want and put 12 inches of alfalfa hay on it. And leave it there till it breaks down, and generally that'll be somewhere between 3 and 6 months, depending on where you are. And then see how soft underneath it is. You didn't do anything except put the alfalfa there, but the association between the soil and the alfalfa. It's just a slow, steady feed to those microbes. And the microbes themselves can do a great job at loosening up a soil if you've got enough nutrient there or enough material there for them to live on. And that's how they improve that physical structure. Release of plant nutrient elements from insoluble, inorganic soil minerals. Most of the minerals we have in the soil are not available to the plant. They're in what we call locked up or tied up forms. When you put on manure or compost or something that stimulates the microbial activity in that soil, you actually stimulate them to produce organic acids. And those organic acids and the activities of the microbes actually begin to release some of those nutrients that are tied up, to the point that if we have someone who uses 3 to 4 tons of poultry manure per acre, or composted poultry manure, however you want, you can use talk about the manure itself or compost, or 6 to 8 tons of cattle manure per acre. You do that 3 years in a row, keep track of what phosphate and potassium you have in your soil before you start. Keep track of how much you're putting on in those tons of manure that you apply. Measure the levels every year and see if somewhere in the third or fourth year, if you don't wind up with more phosphorus and potassium in that soil than you put on in your manure. You get more than you applied, because the microbes that you're stimulating are actually breaking down some of the unavailable phosphorus and potassium in those soils. Some soils, the potassium go up really quick. Other soils, it doesn't go up very fast at all, depending on how much is there to break down and what the other situations are. In some soil, phosphate break down really quick. Others, not so. And guess what? It depends on the kind of manure you use, what you can expect. If you're using pig manure, phosphate generally tend to break down faster or become available faster than potassium. If you're using cattle manure, potassium becomes available faster than phosphorus. If you're using poultry manure or sheep manure, generally it's about even. The P and K generally will come close to even if you use those manure. Now, that's just generalization, and you can find some, you know, you can find some cattle manures that are high in phosphate, but generally, potassium is what cattle manure builds, or compost made from cattle manure, and phosphorus is what compost made from pig manure or applying pig manure builds fastest. They'll build them both, but they'll build one faster than the other. Microbes also fix nitrogen in the soil. Well, yes, they do. The rhizobium help fix nitrogen in the legumes, and even the blue-green algae that are in that soil, if you stimulate it enough, if you get enough going, they can actually add nitrogen to the soil as well. The safest way to do that, though, is to take a nitrate and ammonia analysis and know you have it there. Don't just assume it's going to happen. Improve plant nutrition through mycorrhizal relationships. That comes back especially to phosphorus. In the presentation we put on in phosphorus, we actually show a mycorrhizal relationship there. And the mycorrhizal will colonize a cell in the plant and then just send out mycelia all over the plate. It'll just send out, it looks like a root system, and really everything that's brown is a root. Everything that's gray or white looking is not a root at all. It's the mycorrhiza. And if you ever wonder how effective that is at making phosphate available, if you grow corn in a river bottom, and the year we had our 500-year flood was 1993, all the farmers in the river bottoms got flooded out along the Mississippi and along the Missouri, and the corn was in, it was in July, the corn was made, but none of it was harvested. So the farmers the next year asked the question, well, what do we do? You know, do we put on more phosphate? We put on all that phosphate last year. Oh, no, you don't need to put on any more phosphate, because the soil test shows your phosphate's really high and you didn't take a crop off last year. If you got excellent phosphate levels, no need to put it on. It didn't matter what your phosphate level was. If you didn't put some starter phosphate on your corn that year, it was like having belt-high corn where you put starter phosphate and knee-high corn where you didn't. Because there would be farmers who would forget to turn it on the end, or farmers who had a hose break or get a hose come loose and they didn't apply any or stop up, and you could see right where it all happened. Why is that? Because of that mycorrhiza right there. Because once you kill out the mycorrhiza fungi in a soil, it takes about 8 weeks for it to build back. You can do it with anhydrous and it takes about 8 weeks to build back. You can do it with floodwaters. That's why in rice fields, it's the hardest thing for us to grow corn after rice. Used to people say, oh, it's because of the nitrogen. No, you can put all kinds of nitrogen on there. You can put phosphorus on there. But that mycorrhizae of the fungi is what increases the ability of that phosphate to work. So in terms of soil organisms, do what you can to cultivate the mycorrhizae of fungi in your soils. In other words, try to keep it from being flooded for, well, basically, as I understand, it has to be flooded for a week or more before it'll kill out the mycorrhizae of fungi. But then once it happens, it's 8 weeks for them to come back. Now, if that happened in July, guess what? It got too cold too fast. Before the soil's dried, it got too cold too fast. So we didn't have the mycorrhizae fungi populations back in order to do the job that they had been doing. And every soil test that's run for phosphorus is counting on the mycorrhizae fungi doing their job. If they don't, you're not going to get the phosphate in there. Last, antagonistic action against plant pathogens. I'm not a plant pathologist and so forth, and I don't really stay on that very long because I don't feel like I'm qualified to tell you what all the soil organisms do in terms of plant pathogens. You have to talk to someone else on that. But organic matter, we talked about soil organisms. Organic matter is the real food source for the microbes. And that contributes to soil productivity in several ways, improves physical condition. Why? Because it feeds the microbes, and the microbes actually do that work. Increases water infiltration. Well, you know, in that kind of a case, organic matter may shade it, hold the water in place or shade it. So we can't give all the credit to microbes there, but we probably can give some. Improves tilth, same thing. Decreases erosion losses, and that probably is just because of the organic matter holding things in place, but then supplies plant nutrients. Again, that's coming right back to without the microbes, it's not going to supply those plant nutrients. So what we're looking at there is organic matter without the microbes coming in and breaking it down is not going to be that beneficial. But on the other hand, microbes in the soil without the organic matter, that's their food source. So if we're going to encourage life in the soil, we need to preserve our residues and so forth, put it back in. When you burn the wheat stubble off a field, you're not just burning it off and enabling it to dry off, but the carbon that goes into the air, the nitrogen that goes into the air, is a loss of building humus, but you lose something else too. You lose your moisture holding ability. I have clients that in the state of Missouri where I live, it actually comes out from the Extension Service in the reports and tells the farmers, burn your wheat straw so you can get your soybeans planted faster. And I'll have client after client, we start with them, say, Neil, should we burn our wheat straw? And you can say no all day long, but just saying no, that's no experience. So what I've told them is, okay, just take a field and on half of it work your straw in and on the other half burn it off. If you've been burning all the time, burn it off on that other half. I had one farmer that had five farms, and they did it on every field. Worked in half, burned off the other half. Where they planted soybeans, where they planted peas, didn't seem to make much difference. But where they planted grain sorghum, every place where they planted grain sorghum, because it's dry land, it's not irrigated, every place they planted grain sorghum, 3 days before the side where you worked the straw in, 3 days before, the leaves would curl on the side where you burned off the stubble. Gave you 3 extra days of moisture, and it happened, like in that case, that year, they happened to get dry 3 times between the time it was planted and the time it was harvested. All 3 times, the side that got burned off had 3 days left. In other words, it just shriveled up or rolled up 3 days sooner than the other side. They gave them 9 extra days of moisture on the one side as compared to the other side. How many days of moisture do you need before it's an advantage of keeping that stubble? Manure, when you apply manure, yes, that's a source of organic matter, and it can feed the microbes in the soil. But again, when you put that manure on, it depends on whether that's got a lot of carbon in it or whether it's straight manure. If it's a straight manure and you're putting it on, you better have other sources of carbon there, like crop residues or something of that nature, or else instead of actually improving your humus content, you're gonna destroy it or hurt it instead of improving it. The reason being, as long as you put something on so that you've got less than 10 parts carbon to 1 part nitrogen, the microbes are going to take all that carbon that they've got and break it down. And if they don't have anything else left, they're going to look for humus because that's their, it's a hard way to do it, but that's their next most available food source. That's where the term burning out humus comes from. When you overuse nitrogen from whatever source, you burn up your carbon, which is taking away from the from building humus in that soil. And not only taking away from building it, but it can also actually cause that humus to decrease. That's, you can lose humus simply because we're stimulating the microbes to turn around and eat it for a food source. In terms of compost, well, again, as I said earlier, we'll get some compost. This is an excellent compost. These fellows build tremendous amounts of compost and do a good job of it. But when we look at a compost, we want to know, number one, we want to know what's the carbon to nitrogen ratio. But also, we want to know the nutrient value of every major nutrient in there, the calcium, the magnesium, in addition to the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and also the sulfur and the sodium. And if you don't know all those things as to when you're putting these on, it gets hard to evaluate, are we going to do harm or are we going to help? Because it isn't just a matter of supplying organic matter to feed the microbes here. All those nutrients in there, if you over-apply one of those nutrients, some of the compost that we get in will have 300 pounds of calcium per ton. You put on 2 tons of that compost like putting on a ton of limestone. If your soil can stand that limestone, that's fine, if it needs it. But if it doesn't need it, now all of a sudden you drive your calcium up. And if you look at any of the literature, it'll tell you when you increase your calcium level, it starts tying up every other nutrient. Calcium will tie up potassium, magnesium, sodium, boron, iron, manganese, copper, zinc. So as you push those levels up, a lot of people look at the NPK in their compost, but they don't look at the calcium, and they don't look at the magnesium, and they don't look at the sodium. You need to know every one of those things if you're going to get this to work. Roots feed by choice in the aerobic zone, as deep as a fence post rots. People just have trouble believing this, but if you put the nutrients, wherever you put the nutrients in the soil, that's where the roots are going to go. Those plants will get a root there to pick it up. I had a client with 1,000 acres of prunes that just couldn't believe this. We finally got them to quit fertilizing under the tree, but fertilize out in the middles as well. Started fertilizing the middles. 1 year later, we're walking down through there, and you could take a pocket knife and dig down, and a quarter of an inch down were little white roots, and they were crisscrossing one set of trees to the other. Those trees will come. When you put the nutrients there, they'll come there, and they prefer the aerobic zone. Why? Because that's where the oxygen is. That's where the aerobic bacteria is. That's where the best digestion of all the nutrients comes, so that your plants can pick it up and utilize it. The top 6 to 7 inches is the aerobic zone generally. You can tell as deep as a fence post rot, some soils that may be as much as 8 inches, not much more than that. Notice here, the top 2 inches, 70% of the aerobic bacteria are in the top 2 inches. 70% of your oxygen is also there, and 70% of the humus is built there. In 5 inches, 95% of all the aerobic bacteria are in the top 5 inches, and that's where basically all of your humus is built, in that 5 inches of soil, which means if you're going to work in residues, try to work it into the top 5 inches. That's when you get the most from it. Again, if you're going to work in your compost, try to get it in the top 5 inches. If you're going to work in a green manure crop, whatever it may be, supplying organic matter helps feed the average-sized cow in terms of an acre of soil organisms. But nutrients from the minerals and the soil humus feed the crops. In other words, the microbes do their job, and then we're actually, as we feed those microbes, if we put there what they need, they'll actually put in what the crop needs. This is a lupin crop in, I don't know why we went to there, but anyway, this is a lupin crop in Australia, and notice what they do. They plant in the old, leave the old barley or wheat stubble there, and then plant in it, and the fellows will tell you in these dry years, they're getting much, much better response because they haven't gotten the rain, but all that organic matter on top helps preserve the moisture, all right, but it's also a nutrient source because the interface between the mulch and the soil itself keeps that moist for a much longer period of time, and in this kind of a case, when you just leave it on top, you're giving a good slow feed to the microbes. If you take that and work it all in, now all of a sudden you'd better be sure that you have at least 1 pound of nitrogen for every 100 pounds of residue you put in, or else you're going to rob that crop of the nitrogen it needs. Now, how would you rob a lupin crop, which is a legume, how would you rob that of the nitrogen it needs? Well, that lupin crop doesn't just need the nitrogen that comes from the rhizobium bacteria on the roots. Because when you start looking at the various crops, whether it's a soybean crop or whether it's any type of a legume, Dr. Robert Fisher at Virginia Commonwealth University back in the 1970s did a study on soybeans, for example, and he said, under excellent conditions, 70% of the nitrogen a soybean crop needs comes from the rhizobium on the nodule, on the root nodules. But he said, under average conditions, soybean crop only gets 50% of its nitrogen from the nodules, and you got to come up with the other 50% from somewhere else, either from the humus or from somewhere. And he said, under very adverse conditions, as little as 25% of the nitrogen comes from the nodulation, and the other 75% has to come from some other source. If you don't have good nodulation, in other words, you can say, well, we're getting all this from the legumes, but you're not getting it. And even at the very best, 30% of the nitrogen that crop requires is going to have to come from someplace other than what those nodules produce. The higher the yield, the more critical that becomes, because the higher the yield, the less chance the humus content you have will supply it. But I will tell you this, if you keep that residue on there, if you start out and you're a farmer, and you start out and you don't have residues on your soil and you have a low humus content and you start keeping those residues on, just see if within 3 to 5 years the humus content in your soil doesn't go up. And I don't mean that it'll go up by 0.1%. And this is the hard thing for a lot of people to believe, because the USDA Yearbook of Soils 1957 makes a statement that it takes 20,000 pounds of undecomposed organic matter to build your humus by 0.1%. So if you got a 1% and you want to build humus to 1.1, it takes 20,000 pounds of organic matter. How much hope do we have? But you know what? There are two theories, which the other theory has come along later, and that is microbiologists will tell you, it's really not the amount of organic matter you have on your soil that determines how much humus you're going to build. The organic matter is the food source for the microbes, and if you get the ideal there so that you can produce more microbes, it's really the breakdown of the body of the microbes that make humus, not the breakdown of the organic matter. So if you can build this up so that microbes feed on microbes, not just a matter of giving them the ideal environment so the population can come up, and I've seen cases where By correcting the soil and treating the soil, they've increased microbial populations by 36 times in the very same soil compared to the control. When you can do that, that's where you come out with the advantage of the microbes in the soil are helping to build that humus content. I have a client that for 5 years, he'd never grown anything but soybeans for 20 years, and for 5 years that we were working with him, he started working with his soils and building the soils up, and his humus content went up by 1.5% in 5 years. Well, if it went up by 1/10, you're supposed to have 20,000 pounds of undecomposed residues. All he grew was continuous soybeans. He didn't have any 20,000 pounds of residues a year. But I guarantee you, it wasn't a mistake, because all his neighbors around him also were in our program. Now, when I say they were in our program, they were in the program as far as having the soil tested, but they weren't doing the same things as far as preserving the soil life. Cattle manure, whatever type manure you're using, analyze it before you put it on and see what the carbon to nitrogen ratio is, not just the fertilizer value, but also the carbon to nitrogen ratio, because if you got a lot of straw in it, then there are times when you need to add extra nitrogen just to get it to break down to keep from robbing all the nitrogen, keep the microbes from robbing all the nitrogen just to break down the straw and rob whatever it is you're trying to grow there. Again, not just N, P, and K on compost or manures. Go in and test it for nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, yes, but also for sulfur. and also for calcium and magnesium. And if you're around the coast or in any place where sodium might be a problem in the water, also check it for sodium. You can check it for trace elements, but generally the trace elements will be so small that they don't make that much difference in terms of how many pounds you're going to build in the soil. All I'm saying is you could put on the trace elements on any soil that I've ever seen. You don't have to worry, well, oh, you got too much boron or iron or manganese or copper or zinc, and say, well, you can't put it on, you have too much of that. But any one of the others that we mentioned, you can. Always get a nutrient analysis. See what you've got in there, and what I'd tell you, if you're building it up as far as building compost or something like that, or got a lot of straw or wood chips or rice hulls or whatever it may be, if you've got a lot of organic matter in there, get a nutrient analysis and be sure that you get a carbon to nitrogen ratio. And if it's 10 to 1, 11 to 1, 12 to 1, count your blessings and say, this is great. If it's all the way up to 20 to 1, still use it, and you're not going to tie up the nitrogen for the microbes in that soil, but once it gets above 20 to 1, you're going to have to add extra nitrogen or you're going to rob your crop. The Albrecht system of soil fertility says this, and that is feed the soil and let the soil feed the plants. Well, what's happening in the meantime? We're feeding the soil to feed the life in that soil, and the life in that soil will take care of the crops. The basic soil science that we look at, and this is why Dr. Albrecht said, look, if you use this program, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, because the laws of chemistry, physics, and biology don't change whether we're in Minnesota or Missouri or whether we're in some other country. It still works the same way. So he said, if we're using the simple laws of chemistry, physics, and biology, as long as we follow through on the true laws of science, and what he said, here's how you tell what's a true law of science. If it's science, it's repeatable. You can do it over and over and over, and the same thing happens. All right? Well, this is what he always looked for. And he said, if it doesn't work the same way every time, then something's wrong. It's either not science, or we've done something wrong, and we need to find out how the mistake went. Physical properties of the soil. 25% air, 25% water, 45% minerals, and 5% humus would be the ideal. Here we show a little bit different because 3% is more realistic if you want to look at the average, and a lot of people would love to have 3%. So when we start looking at air and water and minerals, this is the ideal soil, but if you don't have that ideal soil, you don't have the ideal environment for the microbes. And so in terms of basic soil science, what the Albrecht program consists of is using soil nutrients. In other words, the fertilizers and the lime and manures and so forth, which is the chemistry, use the chemistry of the soil to correct the soil structure, which is the physical structure of that soil, which then builds the house for the soil life. If you want to have good biology in the soil, you got to have the right amount of air and water, and if you want to have the right amount of air and water, you got to have the right nutrient makeup. And basically what determines that air and water is the amount of calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium those soils have. And if you've got too much sodium, you're not going to have enough air in that soil. If you've got too much potassium, you're not going to have enough air in that soil. If you've got too much magnesium, you're not going to have enough air in that soil. If you've got too much calcium, you're going to have too much air in the soil. Because that's the way those things work. 25% air and 25% water. If you correct the calcium levels, and it's not how many pounds of calcium you have, and it's not the pH, it's the percentage of calcium compared to the percentage of the other elements. And if you want to look at an ideal, somewhere between 65, on a medium to heavy soil, somewhere between 65 and 70% calcium and 10 to 12% magnesium gives you the ideal air and water. And if you wonder about that, find soils that analyze that way and have a soil physicist to check it and say, and see, well, does this have the right amount of air and water? Most textbooks don't tell you how to get it, because unless you look at the percentage of calcium and magnesium in the soil, you'll never know how to get it. And most of the research in the world says this doesn't work. The Albrecht system is old and antiquated. You don't need to know all that. If you don't know this, you can't correct the soil structure, and you can't build the house for the biology. How much production due to lack of proper life in the soil is actually lost year after year on fields, orchards, vineyards, hay, and pasture land by not properly testing each soil and correctly supplying it with needed nutrients? Almost all land is not really checked and then supplied with the proper nutrients, because if you use pH and phosphate and potash, which is a standard that people look at, if you just use everything else right and look at pH to tell when to lime, you're going to lose in terms of the structure of a soil. And the reason you lose is because if you start out with the perfect soil and you watch the pH and how it drops, when the pH finally drops down to the point that you need a ton of limestone, you go and put that ton of limestone on, you don't have the same soil you had before. Even though the pH goes back to where it was before, you see, for every percent of calcium that's driven out of a soil, the magnesium replaces that. It's 1% magnesium for every percent calcium. Only thing is, it takes 400 units of calcium to make a percent. It only takes 240 units of magnesium, which means when the 400 calcium goes out, we only get 240 of magnesium back. Doesn't let the pH drop to show you how much calcium you lost. It will drop, but it won't show you the correct amount of calcium you lost. So that when you finally get that pH down to the point where you need, oh, we need a ton of lime, and you lime back, you have more magnesium and less calcium. As the calcium decreases, less and less pore space in that soil, because calcium actually creates pore space in the soil, magnesium decreases the pore space in the soil. If you use pH, you're going to get caught in that trap, and most all the people in the world get caught in that trap. You got to look at the percentages to know when to do it. Calcium and magnesium are called secondary elements. They are, in terms of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and sulfur take precedence over calcium and magnesium to grow the crop this year, meaning if you're short of NPK or S and you don't put it on there, then that's going to mean more to you if you're short of it than buying the calcium and magnesium, just for the present crop. Calcium and magnesium are the primary elements for soil life, because that's what influences it. A most important aspect of fertility is the balance between elements. Not only is each element necessary, but a balance of all those elements are necessary. If you have too little of one thing, you're going to have too much of something else. If you don't balance it out, you can't have too much of everything, and you can't have too little of everything. If you've got too much of one thing in the soil, you're going to have too little of something else. Dolomite lime has a higher magnesium content, and you need to figure out what kind of lime needs to be applied on the soil. Some soils need calcium and magnesium. Some soils only need calcium. If you put the wrong kind on, it's going to make a mess. And the only way you know to put the right kind on, it make a mess in terms of your aeration and water. And the only way you know to put it on is to look at the percentages. Know what your percentage of calcium and magnesium is and how to supply the proper amounts of both. We need to know in a limestone the calcium content, magnesium content, and fineness of grind. Match the soil needs with the lime contents to optimize life in the soil. If you don't do it, then you're not going to have the right amount of pore space for the calcium and the air and the water. Soil fertility on sandy soils is different than on heavy soils. We need less calcium and more magnesium simply because sand, the problem is too much airspace. You put the magnesium on, it actually tightens that soil, pulls it together, and it won't dry out as fast for two reasons. Number one, it won't dry out as fast because we reduce the porosity. Number two, the Israelis showed that magnesium actually attracts and holds more water in the soil. If you've got too much, that means it's going to be harder to dry out. If you've got the right amount, it means it's going to be ideal. If you're going to build life in the soil, try to keep a residue on that soil all the time so that there's a food source there all the time. The better you can do that, the better it is for the soil life there, because they need that organic matter in order to do their best and to survive and to grow. Earthworms are important. I don't mean to take away from them, but we need all the microorganisms in that soil as well as the earthworms and the other thing in order to get that soil aerated and have the proper amount of nutrients. When it comes to soils, how you treat that soil determines what's going to happen. Now, you may look at that, and some may look at it and say, oh, they're out there spraying a weed killer. Well, maybe so. But there are fellows who go out there and spray microbial stimulants or biological stimulants, and you can actually use those under the correct conditions and build the life in the soil, because we've seen clients that have done that. And the only thing is, the calcium levels need to be between 60 and 70%, and the phosphate levels need to be good to excellent before you get the maximum response from a a biological inoculant or a microbial inoculant. Proper fertility, not using excess fertilizers, optimizes soil life, optimizes yield and quality and profits. Some people say you can't have everything. Well, in terms of that right there, yes, you can. If you supply it right, every one of those things work out better. You can't properly manage what you don't correctly measure. Test, analyze, and then retest. Take a small area and see how it works. Go from there. A good soil test is dependent on a good soil sample. If you wonder about that, our email address is in the booklet. We have instructions on how we recommend you pull soil samples. Other labs may say differently, but always follow sampling instructions provided by the laboratory you're going to use, including sampling techniques for problem areas. I appreciate your coming, and if I have time, I'd like to... Do I have a minute? I have 2 minutes. I want to give you something that's completely different, because you know we come and talk about agriculture all the time, but a friend of mine some years ago sent this to me, and he said, Neil, I'd like to send this to you because I think it makes a lot of sense, and it's called A Nepalese Tantra on Wisdom. The first point, cheerfully give people more than they expect. Number two, don't believe all you hear. Don't spend all you have or loaf all you want to. Number three, never laugh at anyone's dreams. People who don't have dreams really don't have very much. In disagreements, be fair. No name calling. Teach yourself to speak slowly, but think quickly. Take into account that great love and great achievement involve great risk. When you lose, don't lose the lesson. Open your arms to change, but don't let go of your values. Share your knowledge. Done correctly, it's a way to achieve immortality. Be gentle with the earth. Never interrupt when you're being flattered. Once a year, go someplace you've never been before. Remember that not getting what you want is sometimes a wonderful stroke of luck. Learn the rules so you know how to break them properly. Live with the knowledge that your character is your destiny. Live a good, honorable life. Then when you get older and you think back, you'll be able to enjoy it a second time. Spend some time alone. Sometimes silence gives the best answers. Follow the three R's: respect for self, respect for others, responsibilities for your actions. Don't just listen to what someone is saying. Listen to why they're saying it. And finally, trust God, but lock your car. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.